First of all, I'll be doing a lot of reading today, and I'm not a great out loud reader, so listen to the content more than the execution. First of all, before I do anything, I spent some time doing this, and it dawns on me. Well, it doesn't dawn on me. I knew it very well. But maybe some of you don't understand. This is not like something to do over lunch. These guys, our pastors, spend a lot of time doing this. It's not just, oh, look this up, look that up. Yeah, okay, that works. It's time. It's practice. It's dedication. And pastor appreciation means we should consider that. So, bravo. If you knew what they did, you don't even want to know. Okay. I spent many years as a retail appliance salesman. And as I'm sure you all know, that endows me with the ability to read minds. So I'm going to give it a try. Let's see. Really scraping the bottom of the barrel this week. Yeah, okay, maybe. That's true. Let's try it just one more time. What's Tuba Boy doing up there? Thanks, Don. Okay. Enough of that. So I wanted to speak to you a little bit this morning about judgment. But then I thought, these guys are never going to get it. Okay, that was supposed to be me being all judgy in a sermon about judgment. Never mind. You know, it dawns on me, this could be a long morning for you people. We'll try not to make it too long. So I suppose the first year seminary student sort of thing to do would be to drag out the Funk and Wagnall definition of judgment as a basis for study comparison, but I'm not going to do that. I went with Webster's. Definition, judgment. Pay attention. These will come up later. 1. A, the process of forming an opinion or evaluation by discerning and comparing. Keep that in mind. B, an opinion or estimate so formed. 2, the capacity to judge. 2B, the execution of this capacity. 3, a formal utterance or an authoritative opinion. B, an opinion so pronounced. 4, a formal decision given by a court. B, an obligation such as a debt created by decree of a court. And 2, a certificate evidencing such a decree. 5, capitalized, the final judgment of humankind by God. We'll get back to that one too. B, I like this one, a divine sentence or decision, specifically a calamity held to be sent by God. Think locusts in Egypt, that kind of thing. And 6, a proposition stating something believed or asserted. That is what judgment is according to the world at large in academia. So, we generally, walking down the street, if you just point at somebody and say, judgment, go, they're going to have a negative connotation. You don't know me. You can't judge me. Who do you think you are? Who hasn't heard something like that? But you put the word good in front of it, and it gets you a raise. You have good judgment. That's why the girlfriend's father thinks you're okay, is because you show good judgment. It's a virtue. So we run around with these contradictory ideas about judgment. So what does the Bible say about judgment? And I assure you, I am not qualified to give you a citation-by-citation dissertation about the word judgment. But I am capable of looking up some of the basic text, and that's exactly what I did. Romans 2, 1. Again, I'm going to be doing a lot of reading, so just bear with me. You, therefore, have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For at whatever point you judge another, you condemn yourself. Because you, who pass judgment, do the same things. Now we know that God's judgment against those who do such things is based on truth. So when you, mere human being, pass judgment on them, and yet you do the same things, Do you think you will escape God's judgment? Or do you show contempt for the riches of his kindness, forbearance, and patience, not realizing that God's kindness is intended to lead to redemption? That's important. We as humans are not blameless, and so we're not qualified to judge. It really is just that simple. This also contains a warning that the judgment you pronounce will come back on you. A good practical reason to not do it. Now, why aren't we qualified? Well, we have done the same things. Maybe not exactly the same things you're calling somebody else on, but still, we have sin. We're not blameless. Let's stop right there for a second. I once was an alternate juror for a trial in California, and I spent my spring break in a jury. The guy who listened to the case was a judge. He was fairly well respected, but sometime after that was all done, I heard something. He was taken off the bench and disbarred. He had heard that a friend of his family was under investigation, and he let him know. Bad idea. So what does that mean? That means that our actual judges for our judicial system are held to a standard. They have to be knowledgeable. They have to be worthy of being able to pronounce judgment based on the law. And that's what that's about, the law. But they also have to be above reproach. They can't be felons. They can't be convicted. And that's what happened to this poor chap. He was convicted, and that there went his judgehood. But where was I? Maybe we have done the same sins that we're busy condemning somebody else of. Maybe not. But either way, we're just not worthy to be in that position. The second part in that is that we are mere human beings. I brought garbage. This represents our humanity. Well, it represents one aspect of our humanity. I'm holding, if anybody ever listens to this, the paper tube in the middle of a roll of paper towels. It's a little over a foot long, a couple inches wide maybe. I started with a toilet paper roll, but I decided to upgrade. Why do I bring this, and why do I say it represents our humanity? Well, for the simple reason that I can look through it. Okay. Consider this room as the universe. My universe right now consists of Delaney Fisher. Hi, Delaney. That sounds creepy. Let's choose somebody else. Okay, now my universe consists of, hi. That's my universe, because that's the perception I have. My perception is just right here. Now my universe consists of a window with a window curtain in it. Now, is my perception accurate? Yeah, it's accurate. I can see. And if this is the universe, I can see my little tube of the universe. My next question is, if I had to judge you and it affected you in your life, is this considered sufficient for me to judge you? No, of course not. I don't want to be judged based on this little tube, this little round piece of the universe. I want somebody who can see everything. I want somebody that knows backwards, forwards, front, back. Someone who is maybe omniscient. I don't know. That is the point. We don't have the perception to pass judgment. We simply do not. And there is somebody who does. So, this is another reason why we shouldn't be judging. In fact, let's just go on. God's judgment shows his... Okay, that's the second reason, is because we just simply don't have the capacity. God's judgment shows the richness of his kindness and forbearance and patience. God's kindness is intended to lead to repentance, which to me seems to imply that he has a plan. God's wrath, based on his judgment, is not an arbitrary lightning bolt. Though we need to remember that his wrath is real and based in truth, his judgment also comes from love and fairness and compassion. And it is purposed to lead to redemption. This is the judgment I wish to be under. Let's look at Romans 7, also beginning. Do not judge, simple enough, or you too will be judged. Very similar. For the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, when all the time you have a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite! First, take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Again, the word is simply, don't do the judging. Again, the warning that judgment will cause your own judgment, and in the same measure this time. So once again, who is qualified to judge? Yes. Excuse me. And you looking down would be a problem. Acts 17:31. This is another aspect we want to look at. For he, God, has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everybody by raising him from the dead. So let's think about this for a minute. Someone who's qualified to judge, raised from the dead by God himself. Of course it's Christ. But the main point is that God is calling out that he will do the judging. It's not a question. So, in one pronouncement, he specifies that he will be the one who will judge in his time and in his way. He also specifies who he has appointed to do the task and offered proof of this decision. So, if judgment is good, and that it's good to form an opinion or evaluation by discerning and comparing, then what do we do when we see someone that is part of the kingdom of God falling short of righteousness? What do? When we just see somebody walking down the street doing wrong? What does that mean for us? Let's look at Galatians 6, starting with 1. Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore this person gently. But watch yourselves, or you may become tempted. Carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Okay. Another element, Deuteronomy 19, starting with 15. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offense that they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. That's a pretty tough sentence. It's actually tougher than the American judicial system. So, if there is a brother or sister that you feel you need to confront about something, some kind of wrongdoing, you need to make sure that you are speaking about facts that are established. And, probably more importantly, that you need to speak with the goal of love and reconciliation. You are not judge. You are witness. You are mirror. You are helper. Now the story. Our two previous speakers both used stories to help convey their point. That's how Jesus often taught. He'd tell parables that would illustrate a point that might be hard to understand. And Dave Shrout did it, and Kevin did it. Now maybe I'm going to do it. Another thing that I just realized that I'm going to be having in common with my first two speakers, both of them sang something. Not the norm for this pulpit, but I thought, why not? So I'm going to introduce my story in song. Hit it. Oh, we didn't make those arrangements. No matter. Let me tell you a little story about a guy from Uz. He was a good guy, the best there ever was. He had a little problem while he's sitting by a tree. He lost all his stuff and he lost his family. Massacre, robbed blind. Oh, no, I'm not going to go any further. You guys have been nice to me. Besides, there's a quiz. One, who, now, not staffers, because they're not supposed to be working today. Who am I referring to? It's from Uz. He's a good guy. He lost his stuff and his family. Yeah, it's Job. Who knows me is surprised that I went to Job? Nobody. It's an inside joke. I talk about this quite a bit. So, bonus question. What tune did I set that to? Yes, thank you very much. It was the Beverly Hillbillies theme. Doesn't get enough airplay, in my opinion. Okay, so that's my story. I'm not going to tell the story of Job in total because it takes a little over 2 hours to read that, and I'm a slow reader in the first place. What I'm going to try to do is to give you a certain little strata of the story to illustrate my point. Now, it's always dangerous to pick and choose little pieces of scripture. You have to trust me that I'm taking it in a proper context. And by all means, go read Job and check my context. You show me. So let's start. Again, I'm going to be certain sections of it I'm going to read to illustrate one level of the story. Job 1:1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 beasts. He had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among the people of the East. Wow, quite a resume. So, at the beginning of the story, God allows Job to be tested in the most extreme ways. Satan insisted that Job's love and devotion, Job's love and devotion would be ended by pain and loss, and God allowed this to occur apparently to show Satan the error of his assertion. And I use the word apparently very purposefully there, but that's probably a study for another day. Job 1, once the trouble had begun, the remaining servants had come, and he had heard for the first time that his world had collapsed. At this, Job got up and tore his robes and shaved his head. Then he fell on the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." Would you say that then? In all these things, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. Job 2. Now we're getting to the fun part of the story. Well, kind of hard to talk about fun parts of Job. But hey, I will say this about Job. My understanding of the book changed radically from my first reading to where I think of it today. That's just a little bonus for you. Excuse me, I'm not looking down, I'm not good for my nose. When Job's 3 friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Namathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. Comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began weeping aloud. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. They sat on the ground with Job for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they could see how great his suffering was. Now remember, Job lost his family, he lost his stuff, but he also lost his health. He was covered head to toe in painful sores. Ugh. And remember, he was supposed to be ceremoniously clean. He was anything but clean at that point. The 3 comforters, who will hitherto be known as Eli, Bill, and Zoe. Sorry, Zoe. First, we hear from Eli, Job 4:7. Consider now. Now, listen to what these guys are saying in relation to who they're saying it to. What does this mean to Job when he says, "Consider now who, being innocent, has ever perished? When were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it." What's that saying? Job 5:17. Blessed is the one who Blessed is the one who God corrects. So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he also binds up. He injures, but his hands also heal. What is that implying for Job? Job 6, Job gets a chance to respond. Starting 8. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me what I hope for, that God would be willing to crush me, to let loose his hand and cut off my life. Now, Job's having a tough period. That's an understatement. And during these passages, he goes back and forth between wanting God to take him out and just ending this, and wanting to confront God like in a court and saying, I'm innocent. Why is this happening? And turning his head and saying, no, leave me alone. Look away. I'm done. I need. He goes back and forth between these things. And honestly, in his situation, who can blame him? So finally, we hear from Bill. How long will you say such things? Your words are a blustering wind. Does God pervert justice? Does the Almighty pervert what is right? When your children sinned against him, he gave them over to the penalty for their sin. They were wiped out. But if you will seek God earnestly and plead with the Almighty, if you are pure and upright, even now he will rouse himself on your behalf and restore you to your prosperous state. That sounds nice. What does that mean to him, though? Job responds. And again, this is skipping through the story. Job 9:14. How can I dispute with him? How can I find words to argue with him? Though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with my judge for mercy. Even if I summoned him and he responded, I don't think he would give me a hearing. Again, he's looking for a court answer because he feels he's been wronged. There's a lot to that. Well, now we hear from Zoe. Job 11:11. Surely he recognizes deceivers, and when he sees evil, does he not take note? But the witless can no more become wise as a wild donkey's colt can be born human. Yet, if you devote your heart to him and stretch out your hand to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then, free from fault, you will lift up your face. You will stand firm without fear. What's that saying? If you without sin, get rid of the sin in your hand. Don't let sin dwell in your tent. There's more to say on that. And Job is going to go back to it. So in Job 12, starting in, wait a minute, 2. Doubtless, you are the only people who matter, and wisdom will die with you. He's getting disgusted. But I have a mind the same as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know all these things? And by the way, both groups, Job and his comforters, say that back and forth to each other. I'm not inferior to you. I know this stuff. And by the way, they did. This is not just a couple of friends. These are the leaders of their time. These are the counselors to kings. These are the leaders. They're the elite. And they know their stuff. This isn't just a common group of people. So when they say back and forth, I know these things, they do. He still argues that he is innocent. And the funny thing is, in terms of the law, he is. All the way through this, it's not disputed that he did shun evil. He did follow the law. He did what was required of him. And that's really not the issue. He was truly innocent in that way. So Job is getting kind of frustrated with his friends at this point, as you might straightly imagine. Job 16:2. I have heard many things like this. You are miserable comforters, all of you. And they are. But then it happened. I'm just going to read it. I feel a little bit cheated at this point. Job 32:1. So then the three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. But Elihu, son of Barachel, the Buzite, of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. He was also angry with the three friends because they had found no way to refute him and yet condemned him. Now, Elihu had waited before speaking to Job because they were older than he. But when he saw that the three men had nothing more to say, his anger was aroused. So wait, what? There was three of them, right? One, two, three. And now we have Eli Jr. He wasn't in the story. Now, if I go down to the store and spend my $2.95 and buy a murder mystery novel and start reading it, and the guy who done it showed up in 32 chapters out of 42, I would probably want my $2.95 back. They snuck this guy in on us. But it's the Bible. What are you going to do? Now, I realized sometime in my study the same thing that probably set off Eli Jr. here. And this is sort of a central idea. That all the advice offered by the three friends had two things in common. One, it was perfectly correct advice. There was nothing wrong with the advice. It was personally perfectly reasonable advice. They were acting to what they saw in a very reasonable way. There's a lot of good things said by the three guys who are the comforters. But then there's the other thing it has in common. It's dead wrong. Completely wrong. They couldn't be more wrong. And I think that's sort of the point of the morning. Job 33, Eli Jr. I am the same as you in God's sight. This is him talking to Job. I too am a piece of clay. No fear of me should alarm you, nor should my hand be heavy on you. But you have said in my hearing, I heard the very words. I am pure. I have done no wrong. I am clean and free from sin. Yet God has found fault with me. He considers me an enemy. He fastens my feet in the shackles. He keeps close watch on all my paths. But I tell you, in this you are not right. For God is greater than any mortal. Eli Jr. tells him that they're the same. He tells Job that he should not fear him, and his hand should not be heavy on him. He also later in the response says that he wants to vindicate Job. Doesn't that match up a little bit with our look at Galatians 6? He also makes a point that his response is based on what he hears from Job and nothing else. In other words, he is going from what Job is telling him, not something he figures must have happened. The other friends all gave him accurate and compelling advice, but it was all based on what in their judgment must have been done because of the consequences they were seeing, while basically discounting what they heard from Job himself. They lacked God's perspective on what is really going on within Job, so their judgment was doomed to be inaccurate. Now, the story goes on, as you know, Job gets restored. Yay! But this has some time after that. After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken the truth about me, as my servant Job has. Remember what Job said about God in a few places, and that was the accurate. It takes a lot to, you have to really look at Job. Let me find my say. Now, okay, you've not spoken what's accurate about me, as my servant Job has, excuse me. So now, take 7 bulls and 7 rams, and go to my servant Job and sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. So you have not spoken the truth about me, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Namathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. Is it possible that the three friends would have been the only ones actually struck down by God if it weren't for the burnt offering and the prayer of Job himself? God will only accept his servant Job's prayer for them. So, how do we consider all these things going through our daily lives? Ooh, application. We looked at the definition of judgment. That was the very first thing we did. We looked at a couple of biblical passages about that deal with judgment. Not an exhaustive list for sure. And we looked at one biblical example of poor judgment. I thought of one symbol. I want to stop right there for a second. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about, what about the guy just walking down the street, you know, who's drinking and smoking and chewing and going with the girls and doing? What about people just out there who aren't close to godliness? They're not close to holiness. They're not close to sanctification. They're just walking down the street. Well, we're tempted to judge them because we know what we're called to. We're called to holiness. And we think, well, this person's not even close to it. When we look at somebody that's just in the world who isn't necessarily professed to be a Christian, we're trying to hold them to a standard that is not theirs. They have not been called. They have not responded to that call. They could. We know that the Lord is always knocking at the door. God is always calling into people's hearts. But if we start shaking our fingers at people that aren't there yet and put upon them our standards, it's not drawing them to us. We are not judging them because of righteousness. We're condemning them. There may be a time when that person needs that gentle guidance that God, that we can offer through God, but that's not the time. So I was trying to think of a way to kind of consolidate this, some kind of symbol that we could hang our hat on and think about this. And I came up with an odd one. Is there a big sign above my head? Okay. What's it say? Right turn only. So there's a one-way street, and they don't want you going the wrong way down it. They put the right turn only sign. They don't want you turning into a bus lane or a bike lane. They don't want you turning left in front of a huge line of people at a big intersection and cutting them all off. So they put that right turn only sign. So what of the sign? Let me lead you to a little description. The sign's job is to stay steadfast, pointing the right way to go. It stays where it's put, extolling the message put upon it. It always points the correct way, but does not condemn anyone for not following its message. It simply stands as a witness to the right way to go. Could we not say that's kind of our job? The substitution method always works. Is our job to stay steadfast, pointing the right way to go? Yeah. Is it to stay where we put extolling the message put upon us? Yes. At least I think yes. Is it always to point the correct way to go, but not to condemn anyone for not following the message? In my opinion, yes. Is the job simply to stand as a witness to the right direction? I tell you that it is. It's a simple street sign. But I think that's a good description of our job. Now, the judgment comes from the police officer who makes a judgment about the wrong way driver going the wrong way street in the bus lane or the bike lane or wherever they're not supposed to be. And that's where the ticket comes from. That's the judgment. Our job in the scenario is not to be the policeman. Our job is to be the street sign. Now, God's judgment is based on truth, but also demonstrates God's love and forbearance. It shows his kindness and patience and is designed to lead to repentance, to restoration. However scary it might be, the idea of being judged, to me personally, it's God's judgment, not men's, that I wish to be under. I hope you feel the same. Now, there's one more little thing from Job that I wanted to share. And I think it's important. Job 19, the first part of verse 25. When I had first gone through this, I didn't realize this came from here. And I was surprised that it did. Job 19, 25a. I know that my Redeemer lives. That came from there. Think about it for a minute. This is what Job wished to inscribe in stone forever. With all the pain and loss, with all the humiliation and shame, after loss of everything important to him, Job did make mistakes, don't get me wrong. But there is one mistake that he never ever made. The one that Satan said that he would make from the very beginning. Excuse me. Job never removed God from the throne of his own heart. And we must never remove God from the throne of our hearts. Ever. And from that assurance, in the midst of bitter testing, he still had the faith to proclaim, I know that my Redeemer lives. Uh-oh, lost them already. And within that is the reason we need to understand the nature of our judgment and the world's judgment. And it's why, with the Lord as our Redeemer, we need not fear judgment. And we should never substitute our judgment for God's. I know my Redeemer lives. Do you believe that today?